Welcome back to Security Insights, the podcast that takes a deeper look at today's most important issues in cybersecurity and beyond. I'm Stephen Pritchard. Ransomware now accounts for 90% of cyber attacks, depending on which statistics you read. And it's not just the number of attacks that are the problem. Ransomware is becoming more sophisticated, more complex, and also more dangerous. We're seeing double and triple extortion attacks and threats to disclose confidential data, as well as the disruption of day-to-day operations. On top of that, there's the damage caused by the ransoms themselves, with payments used to fund other criminal activities. And this is leading to suggestions in some quarters that it should be illegal to pay a ransom. But will that help? Or is it further punishing victims of what is already a crime? Our guest today is Ian Thornton-Trump. Ian's been in information security for some 25 years. He's currently the CISO at threat intelligence company Cyjax, working mostly with enterprises. He also runs his own MSP in his native Canada, where he previously served as a military intelligence officer. Ian argues that banning ransomware payments is at best misguided, and in many ways, it could make the problem worse. First, though, I asked him to put ransomware in some context and explain why, almost 10 years after the first widespread incidents, it's still such a threat.
Way back in the day, back in 2015, we had a couple of evolutionary steps in this sort of journey to mass attack ransomware, right? We had the scareware, right? That would come up on the screen and say, your computer has been seized or has been locked by law enforcement. You have to pay us 50 Bitcoin at the time, you know, because this was back in the day when Bitcoin wasn't worth, you know, thousands upon thousands of dollars, right? So it was like, it was almost like a cottage industry. And then the scare was just basically it locked it up or it changed the screensaver. It wasn't anything sort of existential, right? No damage was actually done. But because no one had any knowledge about what was going on and everything like that, the cyber criminals at the time, we'll call them proto cyber criminals, made out like gangsters, right? And that was followed by pop-ups with like tech support, scams, and all this kind of stuff. And so that kind of evolved. Where I think it really became a big thing was when auto-propagation was a way of like landing your exploit onto an endpoint and then it being to sort of run the table, if you will, like a schnooker match and throw all of the balls, i.e. the computers, down into the ransomware pockets, right? And that, of course, was really facilitated by WannaCry when NSA penetration tools and exploits were used to great effect. At the time, leveraging an SMBV1 protocol to spread rapidly and completely through a network and through a very large network. That happened before WannaCry, but I think in terms of the cultural zeitgeist that is ransomware today, I think it's fair to say that in the form that we know it now, certainly WannaCry was one of the very beginnings.
And what's happened since? So how's that developed? As these attacks have not been static.
No, they haven't. And as weaknesses in, it turns out coding encryption protocols is difficult, right? But so as it evolved in like a number of different ways. So one was the inclusion of traditional pen testing tools to establish command and control, like using Cobalt Strike, enumerating user accounts, especially ones with privileged access, adding on, you know, a bunch of other pen testing tools to really make that propagation happen within an organization. Then I think we had, you know, some challenges with the bad guys' level of coding expertise when it came to building algorithms that were unreversible or very difficult to reverse engineer in terms of creating a decryption key. And then, of course, we had the design of the ransomware. We need to move very quickly through a system, but we don't want to give off any of the telltale signs that that system is compromised, right? So we had a lot of stealth activity going on so that we could propagate ransomware in the environment and ransomware endpoints without basically giving away the fact that that activity was happening. And still to this day, that's part of the battle. And there were workarounds such as, like, for instance, just encrypting the first, you know, couple of bytes of each file that essentially renders them unavailable, but not the whole file. Then we saw attacks on the main boot, the MBR part of the computer that basically is the giant index that says where everything else is. And if you successfully ransom that, then it essentially makes the computer, you know, useless and all the information on it difficult to retrieve, not impossible. So cyber criminals and the manufacturers of ransomware in general have had their own sort of development path, if you will. And then, of course, the EDR, the XDR, the MDR, whatever you want to call it today, vendors that are out there have been sort of chasing the tail as new and innovative attacks have happened. And that's kind of where we are today. We've got this epic battle going back and forth between the latest innovations in sort of cybercrime developed ransomware, right? And then the whole cybersecurity industry kind of chasing them.
There are those three building blocks in ransomware, and it's probably worth just spending a moment on those, because you have the entry into the network or into the system, so the penetration, you have the propagation within the system, and then you have the payload, which is the actual encryption, or, and we'll come on to this, some of the other things that they're now looking to do with people's data.
Yeah, like the exfiltration piece that happens now before the ransomware payload is pre-staged. 100% right.
When did it tip over from becoming a bit of a nuisance, say it was scareware aimed at potentially individual computer users, to being a potential threat to enterprises and large organizations? And does that sort of depend on the sophistication of each of those three parts as well? So we know about WannaCry and where some of the tools that we used to build that originated from.
I'm going to use one of my famous quotes in cybersecurity, was that the antidote to bias is cynicism. I think it's when Bitcoin became real money, and the ability of a criminal organization to take a look at it and go, there's going to be a payday here, right? Not only did the appreciation of the value of Bitcoin became a thing, but soon they realized that individuals and small businesses weren't necessarily a lucrative target. The enterprise targets were really within the gun sight ranges of the cyber criminals, because they knew that those companies had some resilience, either money in the bank, they had stocks that they could turn into a ransomware payment, or in a lot of cases today now, they have a business interruption or cyber security insurance policy. And so, you know, once the first cyber criminal essentially started pulling down lots of money and splashing it around in the cyber underground, everybody else, you know, adopted it like the latest innovation in cyber criminal activity, and dropped, you know, the a lot of the other traditional attacks that we've seen.
And what sort of percentage of attacks are now ransomware or a derivative of it?
We don't really have accurate data on this. If you ask any XDR, EDR type of vendor, they'll say it's like 90% or 70%. They're essentially pulling numbers, you know, out of the ether. And the problem is because ransomware and cyber attacks in general are deeply embarrassing. And in the small, medium business section, there's no real requirement to report a ransomware attack if you're fairly confident that the data that might have been exfiltrated, you know, wasn't personal data. You don't have to report it to the ICO, right? There's no duty or requirement to report. They want to try and change that. Fair ball. And that's part of, you know, a bigger picture argument. But essentially, where we find ourselves today then is in this weird sort of space where organizations that have deep pockets, organizations that may have interesting, shall we say, data from a cyber criminal perspective, these become the targets. And, you know, a lot of people used to think ransomware attacks were sort of very random. They're either kind of random in that the bad guys have figured out something that is used by a lot of people on the internet and have found a way to exploit that, right? Or it is very much a targeted attack with a lot of reconnaissance, a lot of, scrutinization of companies' annual reports to see what kind of deep pockets they are. So there's sort of like, a bunch of different approaches now as a cyber criminal to market, if we can use that term. And some of it involves quite a lot of a detailed reconnaissance, and others are just essentially spraying and praying that they found a way in to whatever business. And I feel like those are the more dangerous ones, right?
And what else has changed in terms of the ability to breach defenses, in terms of the motivation? Because we've seen this become a very popular, perhaps almost the default form of cyber attack for a lot of groups. But technology has to some extent enabled that to happen.
It has, and it's also the people. Let's not forget that a lot of the, I'm going to say, hardcore offensive cyber actors, they're all getting into their 40s and 50s. And if they started back in the day, as 20-year-olds, they've already got, 20 years of experience in breaking into networks and probably are retiring from whatever previous legit job or government job they may have had. And now they're going cyber criminal entrepreneur, right? And this is because they've got the skills, essentially to do cyber attacks. As that industry has evolved, what we've seen is nation states embrace an actual cyber criminal operation and protect them from, the Americans mostly, but let's call it as it is, Interpol and Europol's kind of attentions, because they are in a way continuing to support an aggressive national policy objective with attacking, the West and the Europeans in concert with the actual advanced persistent threat forces that may be reporting to the military, reporting to the intelligence services. So there's been a bleed over of skill sets. And it's not surprising to me that some of the more advanced intelligence services exploit teams are also now finding themselves quite comfortable kind of moonlighting.
Also, though, we've seen some changes in what they're trying to do. So originally it was encrypting data. Now we've seen exfiltration of data, and we've seen the threats to put that data on the dark web exploited in different ways. How much of that is changing the way we respond to this, and how much of that is changing the type of people who are involved in it as well?
It's really interesting that that tactic has taken place, because then there's also that other tactic that we saw, where it's, I'm going to report you to the regulator because, I have proof that you've been data breached on top of it, right? Like, so that's the triple extortion ransomware play, right? It's phenomenal that this is targeting the worst habits of IT in businesses, which is to keep all the things like pack rats. We're data pack rats, right? And so the more data that you have on a system, the more risky it becomes should that system be exploited. So there's actually no easy solution to this problem other than taking stock of what we actually need to conduct business and starting to get rid of all of that old data that basically, if it gets into the grips of the cyber criminals, they will try to use it to elicit a ransom from you. So, we have this challenge with data management. We have this challenge with, preventing the exfiltration of the data from an organization, which requires tooling and visibility that that organization may not have invested. And then we have on top of it, we have, okay, do we need to report this data breach, or is it going to be reported for us by the cyber criminals? So businesses now have a much more difficult and complex scenario to kind of role play out within their organizations than they ever did before. And this is why I think the marketplace for managed detection and response, companies that are very comfortable with dealing with companies in crisis, either during the crisis itself as incident responders, or, you know, tabletop workshops that run through these scenarios, the type and aggressive behavior of the cyber criminals has you know, it's gone to 11, in the words of Spinal Tap.
So we've got a complex attack and we've got a complex set of responses and responsibilities within organizations. But one of the things that's become increasingly controversial is the question of whether or not to pay the ransom. Now, we don't necessarily know which organizations have paid ransoms. Very few would disclose that.
Yeah.
We have even less data around how many cyber insurance policies have paid out, for example.
On top of that, if it's done through a law firm, it's subject to legal privilege. So there is a lot of obscurity as to the type of statistical models that we can say. We know anecdotally that many enterprises have admitted candidly, and in some cases under Chatham House rules, that they have indeed paid the ransom simply because other deficiencies in the business were identified. And we know, for instance, that the Colonial Pipeline attack, which is used as a quite an interesting discussion point, because they were so transparent about what happened, they essentially had a backup and recovery and resiliency capability, but they chose to pay the ransom. Now, again, when we go to that cynicism, it's quite possible that the FBI, because they were involved very early in the Colonial Pipeline investigation, possibly actually encouraged the company to pay the ransom because they had already figured out kind of who the bad guys were and were waiting for that transaction to take place so that they could further their own investigation into that ransomware group, right? So it's not always what we think we see of pay or not pay. Sometimes the advice can be essentially, you know, the double cross of the bad guys by law enforcement who have already had a presence inside that organization. So it's a fascinating sort of mind exercise to discuss.
So it's rarely clear cut, but one thing we are seeing is some calls to say that you shouldn't be allowed to pay the ransom. What's behind that?
So I think it's the frustration of the fact that it is costing the economies, especially knowledge-based economies like ours, quite a bit of money and is very disruptive to both shareholders of public companies, but also to small and medium businesses.
Where's the pressure coming from? Who's advocating banning the practice of paying?
I think it comes from a number of places. I mean, certainly insurance companies who've been paying out, quite a bit of money to organizations that have succumbed to a ransomware attack. I think that's probably one group advocating for it. The other groups are probably close to the government in terms of policies, sort of to try and show that there's action taking place, that they're you know, making sure that cyber criminals' life are as difficult as possible. And banning ransomware payments is sort of an optic, I think, to try and suggest that we're taking this situation seriously. I would add, though, it's one thing to take a situation seriously. However, it's quite another to actually be effective. And I think that's where I sort of come off the benches, as you were, and say, surely we can't be in a position where we land another fine or penalty on an organization who's exhausted commercially reasonable methods to get back in business and decides that paying the ransomware is in the best interests of their employees and the future prosperity of that business. I don't want to put handcuffs on innocent people.
That is part of the problem, isn't it? Because it may be a straightforward commercial decision.
That's right. And in conversations with folks that work close to organizations that essentially have either gamed out a ransomware scenario, paying can be the easiest and most expeditious way of getting the business back in business.
But it looks bad, as you say. It looks bad from a governmental and from a political level because we're handing cash to criminals.
Absolutely. You know, and there's no question about that. And that's, I think, one of the reasons why we see these advocacy sort of and discussions about banning ransomware payments. And again, you know, I kind of feel like we need to approach the problem at a far more organic level. And that is perhaps either establish alternative methods for funding businesses that succumb to ransomware, such as increasing, and I know no one likes the word increasing, but perhaps increasing your annual fee to the ICO to establish a super fund, if you will, for businesses that get cyber attacked, making cybersecurity essentials a mandatory data protection requirement with an annual filing requirement, simply like the ones that we have now that we have to file at Companies House. We need to file a cyber state or a cyber certification, self-attestation, or better, third-party audit. There are a number of different ways to approach this. You know, I actually joked a little bit like, well, if we're going to make paying ransomwares illegal, why don't we make not having a backup and testing your backup illegal? To me, in my sort of capacity as a cyber sort of leader of some sort of repute, I don't think we can just pass a law, make ransomware, payments illegal and expect that, oh yeah, the cyber criminals are like, we're not going to attack the UK anymore because they made those ransomware payments illegal. I don't see it happening that way. And it's certainly not a global solution by any stretch.
It's balancing the two sides, isn't it? Because if you need to legislate to prevent the ransom payments, but you're leaving a gap because there's no mandatory requirement for security, you end up in a situation where the victim is paying out more and more for something that at the end of the day was a criminal act.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to criminalize a response to a criminal act. And the other piece of it is who's going to do that enforcement work, right? And that investigative work. We have a limited amount of cybercrime assets within law enforcement and the intelligence services today, right? Out of that group are a smaller number of cyber literate folks. So even if we were to pass one of these laws, what organizational body would have the capacity? And what happens again, you know, are you going to really justify spending, you know, $50,000 or $60,000 of an investigator's time, over a $5,000 or $10,000 ransomware payment? There's no conceivable ROI at the small, medium business level.
What though then, or what should then organizations do though to defend themselves? Because one of the problems with this whole process is, of course, paying the ransom doesn't guarantee that your data will be made back available to you or decrypted. You won't necessarily get your data back, and it doesn't prevent the crime groups from publishing that data or selling it on. So, assuming that prevention is better than cure, but where would your starting point be if you were to advise CISOs? And I'd also add CIOs and boards to that, because they're very much a key part of this.
First, it comes down to prepare for the inevitable, right? And follow the guidance that, you know, NCSE and other organizations are putting it out there, and really understanding how and why you may get cyber attacked. That's all part of sort of the risk analysis that we're being asked to do under NIS, under NIS 2, even though the UK hasn't signed off on NIS 2, in the Telecom Security Act, and of course in DORA as well, the Resiliency Act that is requiring financial services organizations to really up their game when it comes to things like ransomware. So I see this as, first of all, the call to action is really pay attention. Okay. The second part of this is look at the estate and adequately fund it. And there is also a potential business model that suggests that maybe declaring how much of your annual turnover you've spent on cybersecurity, we could establish a minimum requirement, a minimum level or percentage. There's a number of different ways to approach this. And what it doesn't require is somebody coming out with a grand policy statement like banning ransomware. What it requires is engagement with a number of the stakeholders in the industry, the insurance industry, government, law enforcement, to look at feasible ways of tackling the problem. And maybe it's a combination of all of them. Right? But we can't just think, legislation, can't come with the idea that everything is a nail and it's the big hammer. That's not how it works in practical terms.
And I know this gets said a lot, but, and you alluded to it earlier on in the conversation, many of the vulnerabilities that ransomware groups exploit are actually ones where we know about the patch, we know about the fix, and they've simply not been deployed. So what does an organization need to do to get on top of that problem?
And nothing could illustrate this more than the recent discoveries of Volt Typhoon and how the Department of Justice in the United States and the FBI became the Department of Vulnerability Management and Patching to actually dismantle the command and control botnet that the Volt Typhoon, the Chinese threat actors have been using. And this is not without precedent. The Department of Justice have done this to Exchange servers that were exposed, and they've also done it to WatchGuard firewalls at the very beginning of the Ukraine war because the Russians had created a giant botnet. We have the will, skills, and capability, no question. But again, this comes back to understanding your business's exposure, understanding the threat model that your business presents, and then being prepared in the organization for if a cyber event were to happen, how are we going to respond? The last thing you want is the clown car to come out into the center of the arena while the company is in crisis with a whole bunch of people running around, and then to get back in the clown car and they drive away to the next crisis. That's not a sustainable response for any organization. And we quite simply, we've been living with arguably ransomware for the last 20 years. I think we can probably say no one is unaware of the potential for that to happen at their business now. Now, I get that there's exceptional circumstances and I can understand that and be sympathetic towards it. But if you're nailed with a five-year-old vulnerability, I think you have to ask a question if not, like, put that down on the performance review, especially if the FBI comes to your door and says, "Would you please patch your infrastructure because it's compromised?" So, we just need to raise the bar in terms of our cybersecurity knowledge. And this is not geared towards the professionals out there. This is geared towards the executive teams and board members. And if their knowledge comes up and if they can understand the business risk, because the business is communicating to them in language that they understand, I think we can turn the tables here without resorting to what appears to be fairly authoritarian policies, such as you're not allowed to pay a ransomware or you'll go to jail or get further fined. I see this as sort of like the battlefield of where we try different things and some things will work and some things won't work. And, we still are looking for, I think, if it can be said, the 80% solution, because we know that 20% of the things that we try just may not be effective.
Ian Thornton-Trump on why regulations to outlaw ransomware payments are misguided and could even be counterproductive, and why there are other steps the industry can take to reduce the ransomware threat. That, though, is all for this episode of Security Insights. We'll be back in 2 weeks' time, and our guest will be Anes Beaucazin, Chief Business Security Officer at HR outsourcing firm ADP. She'll explain what a CBSO does, how it differs from the role of the CISO, and how enterprises are having to increase their security teams to tackle a growing number of threats. Until then, do catch up on past programmes on our website, securityinsights.co.uk, or subscribe and rate the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Amazon, and Spotify. Thanks again for listening.